Welcome to Nevada Newsmakers. On the broadcast today, Gregory Lisa, attorney and partner with Hogan Lovells, a D.C. law firm. He's an expert in money laundering cases and also compliance in the gaming industry. It's all coming up next on an all-new Nevada Newsmakers.
Nevada Newsmakers is brought to you in part by the Tahoe Reno Industrial Center, Pro Group Management, and the Retail Association of Nevada.
I'm Paul Enos, CEO of the Nevada Trucking Association. Truck drivers are some of the hardest working people you'll meet, delivering over 70% of America's freight and 92% of Nevada's. When there's a natural disaster, they're delivering critical supplies to help those communities recover and rebuild. Every sector of the economy and our nation's military rely on truck drivers. So let's take a moment to say thank you. On the open road or city streets, our truck drivers are rolling to make our economy and our nation stronger. Trucking moves America forward.
How do you shed some light on a better economy? Start with growth inspired by Valley Electric Association. We're a member-owned power company that puts Nevada first, and we're doing big things, like providing prosperity by securing renewable energy projects. For Nevada, that means more jobs and more opportunities, all for a strong statewide economy. In other words, together, we're doing powerful things. Visit us at vea.coop to learn more.
This is Nevada Newsmakers with host Sam Shan, a no-holds-barred political forum. Now, from the Nevada Newsmakers broadcast headquarters, here is Sam Shan.
And back on Nevada Newsmakers, we're pleased to welcome to the program for the first time Gregory Lisa. He is a partner at Hogan Lovells, where he uses his extensive firsthand experience in anti-money laundering investigations to help financial institutions, institution clients, navigate the complex regulations and expectations of regulators, examination teams, and law enforcement agencies, both civil and criminal. Before joining the firm, he was the interim director of the Office of Compliance and Enforcement at the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, FinCEN, the Treasury Department's lead regulator for overseeing and enforcing anti-money laundering laws. And my original plan with Mr. Lisa was to talk to him about compliance for gaming companies, and then Paul Manafort happened. So if you would share with us your thoughts. Let's start out with why the Justice Department went with a no-knock warrant home invasion of Paul Manafort. Why would you do that?
You know, I have to say, I was when I had heard about that, when I saw the public reporting about that, you know, I used to, as you know, Sam, for about 10 years when I was with the Justice Department as an organized crime prosecutor, you know, we used them, my agents used them, you know, and you know, it was, you know, to me, that was cops and robbers. It didn't get any more cops and robbers than that. We would typically, though, use those in a situation where there's a, we use them in drug cases or in violent crime cases where there's some need for an immediate breach of the premises. So you otherwise would be able to just knock on the door, identify who you were, and then wait for the person to come to the door. Typically, those are, I mean, they are frequently used, but often not in white-collar cases in the absence of there being a showing, and you do have to make a showing that of a likelihood of a destruction of evidence or some other obstructive conduct.
In this particular case, at this point, since this is developed, Manafort is trying to put up a lot of property worth millions to get toward bail. After having had a no-knock warrant home invasion, why would a judge grant bail?
Well, I think basically, and if I'm, you know, I saw the reports out of the detention hearing and the proposed deal. I think basically it would just have to be some assurance if I were a judge, and if there's a risk of flight. I mean, typically in a detention proceeding where someone is trying to get bail or an adjustment even of terms of home release, which is basically what this would be, you would have to show that you know, there's a sufficient guarantee that the person is going to show up for whatever other proceedings, judicial proceedings, or if the person does get convicted and sentenced, that they'll show up to prison, that they won't be all of a sudden disappeared. So I, typically be that. So it's a little bit different in the search warrant context, where they may not be concerned about the person fleeing as much as the person, and again, in a violent crime case, you know, having a violent response to a home breach, or in some other situations, a destruction of evidence or you know, deletion of hard drives or things like that, that would cause law enforcement to be concerned in that period of time where they have a search and knock at the door, that all of a sudden some of their evidence dissipates.
And is this, you know, from a prosecutorial standpoint, a situation where Bob Mueller and his team are putting out the gun and saying, okay, for all you people that we've been talking to or haven't been talking to that may know something, this is the time to cut a deal, because otherwise you can see we're going after you?
I think it's, I don't think that the charging documents is already released, both in the plea as well as in the indictment. You know, those are speaking documents. They definitely lay out a lot of what the investigation has been looking for, and it certainly Mr. Mueller and his team have a lot of experience in what's known as enterprise prosecutions, making sure that they are not just going after, you know, one potato, two potato kind of whack-a-mole type of prosecutions, but working their way through an entire organization or operation. And it doesn't even have to be a formal operation, right? So I think it's definitely, there's definitely a certain amount of signaling there. And really, this is an experienced team that has a lot of background doing exactly that, of kind of making sure they're going after this intentionally and thoughtfully to make sure that they're building, you know, building from person to person.
Did it surprise you that this particular indictment came down to money laundering?
No, it doesn't. I mean, it doesn't at all surprise me in a case like this or in other cases that he and his team have, the individual members of this team have done in the past. I mean, people always looked at enterprise prosecutions through the prism of like a RICO charge, you know, the 1970s statute. But really, when you think of it, money laundering is a very useful way in a case where there are very complex money flows, where that is often the motivator behind, you know, how people and companies act. That's often the incentive, and also it's often the way that where the evidence flows. I mean, it's basically two things. It's both the incentive, as well as sometimes the most promising evidentiary material, because witnesses can lie you know, or they'll be incentivized to do certain things, you know, to speak, if they've got an axe to grind, to testify a certain way, they can be impeached. But a financial document, especially one where you've got their authenticity, they don't lie. And they show connections between people and parties and companies, shell companies and shelf companies, in ways that are very, very telling, and often show relationships where those relationships would otherwise not be apparent.
The president could have the opportunity, if he chose, to pardon Paul Manafort. But that would not protect Manafort from the states, because these are state crimes too, correct?
Yeah, I think, you know, many states, you know, have similar types of crimes on the books. And also many states, if you have a tax filing, you know, you could also be charged with a false tax filing charge. People always looked at money laundering as a uniquely federal crime. But if you look at it, there are certain state hooks, some in the wire fraud context, some with a state money laundering violation, and certainly some with state violations. So it would pull it out of the reach of a federal pardon if there's a state charge that goes that way.
One more question on this topic. General Michael Flynn, already asked for immunity from the congressional committees to testify. Where does this put him at this point in time?
You know, I think it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out, because I think those, you know, any requester of immunity and then follows through on that or follows through with the compulsion, I think basically everyone's looking at that, both the people on the Hill who are deciding whether to grant that request or to condition that request, as well as the prosecutor's office, both state and federal, if they're both looking at Mr. Flynn to say, let's see how this plays out. So it's definitely an interesting move. I don't think the die has been cast as whether or not it will be granted, and also if it would cover everything he would hope to cover from that.
And you don't think that it's already in process and we just don't know about it?
I think there's a ton of stuff that we don't know. I think there's a lot of unknowns, both in terms of who is already cooperating, who is already, I think, you know, one message intended or otherwise by the plea was the message that he had already been cooperating, that Papadopoulos had already been cooperating with the investigation for several months. So if I am an actual or potential subject to that investigation, I might be wondering who else might be cooperating. Maybe there are some other people already charged, and their charge is right now under seal, and it's not an accident, and it's happened in a number of different investigations. You know, you strategically unseal a plea to affect the investigation.
All right. More with Greg Lisip when we come back.
Sully's Sports Bar inside the Tamarack Junction is South Reno's headquarters for locals to watch all your favorite sports. And now you can enjoy your favorite team on our brand new high-def TVs featuring the Papa, the big daddy of them all. It's our giant 17-foot big screen TV wall. And we have two 79-inch high-def TVs, 12 65-inch high-def TVs, including two party booths for your own private party, and six high-def private booth TVs. Bring in your own headphones and listen to your favorite game right from your own seat. First, make your bets in our William Hill Sportsbook, then enjoy your favorite cold beer, libations, burgers, wings, pizza, and our signature build-your-own Bloody Mary bar. Then settle in and download our app and listen to any game being shown in Sully's Sports Bar. Catch your favorite team on our new high-def big-screen TVs. Sully's Sports Bar is the only place to watch your favorite sports all year long. The Tamarack Junction, just north of the Summit Mall in South Virginia.
It's Tamarack Junction, your junction for fun.
St. Ives Florist, for every holiday and every special occasion. For romance. Custom home design. We have the largest selection of fresh flowers in northern Nevada. And we also offer a large selection of unique gift items. Come see me, Lori Ann, at St. Ives Florist, 700 South Wells Avenue, or call me at 333-9190.
This is Nevada Newsmakers.
And back on Nevada Newsmakers, we continue our conversation with Gregory Lisa. He's a partner at Hogan Lovells, a major D.C. law firm. And recently I got my copy of Nevada Gaming Lawyer, which is actually a fascinating magazine. And you co-wrote an article with Jim Dowling headlined, "What Does Your Compliance Culture Mean When Enforcers Come Knocking?" Why is it that medium and large-sized gaming companies aren't in compliance with the laws when FinCEN has made it very clear that you will report all the information that we will require or you will pay a lot of money in fines?
Yeah, you know, it's really been a remarkable couple of years for the casino industry. And I think in large part, it's due to two things historically. The first is that, you know, many casinos, gaming institutions generally never saw themselves as financial institutions, despite the fact that the regs clearly made them so. They said, "Look, you know, fine, we may hold money in a vault, but we're not a bank. You're thinking of you know, Bank of America or Wells Fargo. Fine, we check cashes, cash checks for our local customers, but we're not a check casher, or we wire money, but we're not a wire transmitter." we are ultimately just a form of entertainment. And I think basically the director at the time, Director Shasky Calvary, said, listen, you know, you may be all that. You may have, you know, entertainment and shows and buffets, but you are responsible for handling, you know, millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars of customer funds, income and outgo, and you are a very likely vehicle for illicit finance and for money laundering. The second thing is this, and this is just goes to muscle memory, that basically if you look at the history of enforcement in this space, you know, from 2002 up until 2013, there were a total of 3 FinCEN cases against the casino industry, a total of like $3 million in fines. And you know, in that 11 years, that's what it was. And then all of a sudden, it changes dramatically. You know, in 2014, there was a case, and then 2015, there were 4 cases just in 2015 alone. And then another in 2016, there were 3 cases. And there was more criminal enforcement and individual liability cases. So there's just a sudden, you know, there's a self-perception that we're not financial institutions, coupled with years of non-enforcement. And then all of a sudden that changes in 2014, 2015, 2016. And so it's a dramatic change.
And these have been multiple millions of dollars worth of fines. These have not been chunk change.
No, that's right. That's right. The earlier ones were, you know, $1 million here, a couple hundred thousand dollars there. If you look at what's happened, you know, over the last 2 or 3 years, we're talking about multi-million dollars, and also and some other things as well, like some structural changes, you know, making the casinos and other financial institutions, not unique to casinos, but affirmatively do things like suspicious activity report look back. And then also admitting to their liability, which is a recent change. And many regulators didn't and still don't do that. But FinCEN at the time said, no, if you're not just going to pay the fine and walk away and have that being the cost of doing business, you know, really addressing accountability by saying, we, the financial institution, whether we the casino or we the bank or whatever it is, we admit to these underlying facts and that we violated the anti-money laundering statute. And that's a big deal.
What's the incentive for a casino not to comply?
You know, I think in large part, it's a there is some muscle memory there. There is we're different. We are only entertainment. We shouldn't be doing it. Compliance is costly. Compliance is very costly. I mean, financial institutions, including casinos, if they do their job right, that's not a profit-making center of the operation. It's very much sunk costs. And sometimes if you do that job and you do things like, you know, asking for identification or insisting on the customers of learning the customer's source of funds and things, you know, there is a chance that you scare away certain customers. And so I think, you know, every financial institution, casino or card club or whatever, has that concern. And if the fine is low enough for noncompliance, then it's just the cost of doing business. That's why I think you see the fines go up and up and up, because you didn't want a situation where the casino says, look, if I get caught, I'll pay a little bit of fine, but I'd rather do that than spend the money on compliance, chase away customers, do things like that.
That's remarkable. Okay, let's take a break. More with Greg Lisa when we come back.
Nevada Newsmakers is brought to you in part by the Tahoe Reno Industrial Center, Pro Group Management, and the Retail Association of Nevada.
Hi, my name's Marilyn Miner, and I'm sure you'd agree that Nevada is a very special place to live. I was born here, and my husband and I have raised our family here. I feel it's a privilege to live and work in the Truckee Meadows. I especially enjoy helping my clients reach their real estate goals. Sometimes the smallest details provide the greatest satisfaction. I'd be complimented to talk to you about your next move.
Call Marilyn Miner at Dixon Realty, 742-1280, or log on to marilynminer.com.
The signs and symptoms of cataracts can start out small with subtle changes in your vision. So don't wait. Be proactive and take your vision into your own hands. If you're experiencing the onset of cataracts or just have questions, contact your eye care professional or call Eye Care Associates of Nevada today. Dr. Hiss has years of experience specializing in the surgical correction of eye disorders and has completed over 84,000 vision correcting procedures. At Eye Care Associates of Nevada, we'll change the way you look at the world.
And now, back to Nevada Newsmakers with Sam Shad.
And back on Nevada Newsmakers, we continue our conversation with Greg Lisa. He's a partner at Hogan Lovells, a major D.C. law firm. So a wrinkle that I wanted to bring up is marijuana in Nevada casinos. And Nevada casinos in particular, just because we have now legalized both medical and recreational marijuana, the Gaming Control Board has made it abundantly clear that gaming licensees may have nothing to do with marijuana, that casinos may have nothing to do with marijuana. So we have a situation in Nevada where it's legal for people to go and buy marijuana, but unless it's a private residence, there's no place to smoke it. Where is this heading?
You know, I think there's so much uncertainty in this space, and not just on the state side, but on the federal side, because there's this dichotomy. And right now you have, you know, a real split in the states of, you know, which ones have legalized it, which ones have decriminalized it, which have just let it to for medicinal use or medical use. And I think even on the federal side, where there's been a guidance regarding from the Justice Department, guidance regarding marijuana enforcement, you still have the most recent Attorney General restating the validity of that, what was called the Cole Memo on the federal side. But that doesn't mean that the federal statutes aren't still in place. So you know, whether it's doing financial transactions related to marijuana trade, it is still it may not be enforced. There may be federal restraint in enforcing that, but that's not an exception to the rule. That's right now just in a memo that may get revoked at any time. And I think that's also on the state side, where basically there's this dichotomy of you know, legitimate interest of saying we want to make sure that we don't get. We don't get tainted with this, notwithstanding the state legalization.
We've got about 30 seconds. There was a big concert series, outdoor concert series in Northern Nevada, and put on by a casino company, and reports that everywhere you went, there was marijuana being smoked. And yet, when I talked to an executive at that company, they said that, you know, with 10,000 people in attendance, it was a question of security as to whether they would try to go after the people who were smoking or leave them be, and they chose to leave them be. Is that going to be an acceptable behavior?
I think right now it's the law enforcement and regulators. You know, it just in Vegas alone, you're talking about a $250 million cash problem in terms of industry demand. I don't see a regulator, I don't see a law enforcement agency being able to get their head around that. In the past, it was always we could count on the one kind of choke point on this, right? The financial institutions, to make sure that a financial institution is not going to allow illicit trade to go on. Now, all of a sudden, the open question is this trade illicit? And whether within a state or federal state, I think that's going to be an open question for the next couple of years until there's better guidance on that.
And that's where we have to leave it. But that leaves us to the point where we have so many more questions. We want to have you back. So thank you very much for being here, Greg Lisa, and we'll be right back.
Nearly 200,000 Nevadans work in retail businesses, supporting families and the community. Nevada's retail businesses generated over $2 billion in sales tax revenue in 1 year, including nearly $700 million to help our schools. Shop around and see all that Nevada's retailers offer our state.
We're the Retail Association of Nevada, representing thousands of Nevada businesses.
Businesses that work for Nevada.
Take a look at Pro Group Management and see how your workers' comp requirements can be met head-on. By taking a proactive approach, Pro Group can assure that your company is meeting or exceeding state and federal standards. As you move forward in your industry, Pro Group moves with you, simplifying regulatory tasks, clearing the way so you can get the job done, and look to your future success. Pro Group Management. Workers' comp that works for you.
On our next broadcast, C.J. Hadley, publisher and editor of Range Magazine, and Patrick Donnelly, Nevada State Director for the Center for Biological Diversity. We'll see you then.